why this particular piece of legislation was not supported when it achieves would have achieved a lot of the things that my colleagues are interested in is not a question I can answer.
That's Seattle City Council member Tammy Morales. Unclear on why she didn't get the support of her colleagues on a land use bill she'd been working on for the past 2.5 years. So what happened to the Connected Communities legislation? Plus, what's happening with a new political alliance she's working on over a public safety issue involving vacant buildings? And what are we learning about the City Council's new transportation plan? What's it really going to get done? We're going to talk about that and so much more this week on Seattle News, Views, and Brews, your coffee break political podcast. I'm Brian Callanan. I'm a host on Seattle Channel. The views expressed here are mine, and I am with none other than my co-host David Croman, City Hall reporter for the Seattle Times. David, I got to ask, I saw this post you put out there earlier looking for information from the Seattle Police Department, a request for information. Looked like it was almost going to take a year to fulfill, but have you lit a fire under them to get that document going sooner, or what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to jinx it, but it feels like there's been a little movement, hopefully for the better. We haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah. These things, they just take too long. That's the long and short of it. And I am hoping that you're able to get the document you're looking for, because I'm looking forward to whatever report that may be. So thank you, David, for all your work, and thanks for being on the program. Thank you to our patrons. A big shout out to Eric, who has a question for us we're going to work on answering at the end of our podcast. Thank you, Eric, for the question and for your support. That's one of the many benefits of becoming a patron. We answer your questions. We provide patrons first podcasts as well. All this for just $5 a month. We'll even send you your very own Seattle News, Views, and Brews decal if you can join at that level. Check it out. Find the show on Patreon at Seattle News, Views, and Brews. A big thanks also to Converge Media. The video version of the podcast is on Converge Wednesday nights at 7. All right, let's get rolling. Time for Right Here, Right Now. Well, David, we talked about the Connected Communities legislation from Councilmember Morales last week, and I wouldn't normally follow up on it so soon, but something really unusual happened. The council's land use committee rejected the measure in committee by a 3-1 margin. Councilmember Strauss abstained here, effectively killing the bill even before the full council looks at it. So this measure, a pilot program focused on encouraging the building of more affordable housing, giving some breaks to builders to do that sort of thing, specifically helping communities of color. And I say this is unusual because I just don't recall when I've seen this no vote at the committee level before. Councilmember Morales' office told me this is unprecedented. There's usually a courtesy yes vote of sorts just to get it in front of the full council for consideration. I just wanted your take on this, David. What did you make of this no vote?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. It's all sort of reading the tea leaves a little bit. I mean, you know, we know that Morales is kind of off on her own in some respects politically. But, you know, she's also taken a tone of I want to work with people, and I'm hoping to work with people. And I think she thought that this is a bill that she could do that on. You know, it seemed like the concerns were about, I guess, development involvement. I mean, partially probably because we have this larger conversation happening around comprehensive plan and zoning. But yeah, I mean, I suppose I was surprised. I knew that it wouldn't necessarily receive unanimous support. I was surprised also, though, that it was just voted down.
Yeah,
straight up without a lot more time to discuss it.
Right. I guess, do you think there's any impetus for the full council to say yes on this when it reaches their agenda on April 30th? Is there any path towards that? Councilmember Morales said she would certainly give it a try when I talked with her about this. But what do you think about that?
There would have to be some kind of fairly significant change. I mean, that would be sort of an odd process to do it, because, you know, that's what committee is for, is if you have concerns or things you want to change about it. I mean, that's the opportunity to do it. So you don't feel like you're kind of under the gun of a full council meeting trying to, you know, rewrite the legislation. It goes through committee so that you can hash it out there. So if there were concerns, that they should have been raised in committee. And so, you know, I would be surprised if something changed the full council. I mean, basically the council members would have to decide that they've just changed their mind and that they regret rejecting it. I haven't seen that happen from the city council before. So, yeah, it seems like basically dead at this point, but you know, you can't totally rule it out, but I would be surprised if it was revived.
I would be too. And I thought that one point that was made during that meeting Councilmember Moore made it. And it was this idea of there was a lot of stuff going on. Councilmember Rivera was talking about, hey, we've got this housing levy we just passed. We need to kind of figure out what that's going to do. We're in the middle of this comprehensive plan situation, which is what Councilmember Moore brought up. And she pointed out that, hey, we're working on this comprehensive plan. We could potentially fold in some of these details into the comp plan such that this pilot program that Councilmember Morales was talking about, maybe we can take it more on a citywide level. And I don't know if that's entirely true, but that was at least the thought here. Do you see a way that something that Councilmember Morales is talking about here, trying to encourage development, trying to make sure the communities of color are taken care of, do you see it potentially influencing the comprehensive plan and maybe getting a more citywide look? Any thoughts on that piece?
Yeah, I don't know about a citywide look. I mean, again, I mean, this would have been the time to sort of experiment with something like this. You know, I that would require a fairly dramatic, I think, rewriting of Mayor Harrell's proposed comprehensive plan to do something like this citywide. You know, I mean, if they want to fold in this particular pilot into that comp plan, I guess they could, although this, you know, the comp plan is a 10-year document. I'm
right.
Sure it's going to be a space for comprehensive, for pilots rather. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, again, I guess I'll say that at this point, I'm a little confused about what this council's opinions towards kind of density and zoning are, just because, you know, we've actually heard some council members talk about how they think the mayor's comprehensive plan doesn't go far enough and, you know, have supported this other alternative, which would have more, particularly around kind of transit corridors, more housing than what the mayor's plan proposes.
Yeah, Councilmember Morales is definitely one of those people who wants more from the comp plan. Keep going.
But also other council members too. And so there, you know, there was some sense that maybe this is a council that is going to push a little further on, you know, density and zoning changes for housing. But this vote sort of kind of changes that view a little bit. I mean, you know, I'm not even going to go there. I mean, there are some conspiratorial takes you could take about the politics of the council. But at the end of the day, like I said, I mean, as far as I can tell, Morales has a fine relationship with the other colleagues on the council, despite her politics being different.
Right.
And I don't think that they're like out to intentionally isolate her or anything like that. So that would suggest there is a legitimate policy concern about this. I mean,
right.
Hanya Wu, Councilmember Wu talked about, you know, developers, and there's always, you know, there's a strain of skepticism towards for-profit developers. And this would, you know, I mean, it's talking about commercial upzones. So developers would, I suppose, stand to benefit from this. And, you know, I think in a council that, you know, when you talk about displacement or gentrification, there does tend to be this kind of strain of density skepticism, I will say, that specifically toward like private developers, you know, you'd hear this sometimes from Councilmember Swant or other council members, but, you know, a preference that they solve these problems with sort of public solutions rather than private solutions. I don't know if that was part of the concern here, although, again, Councilmember Wu brought it up. But yeah, like I said, it kind of leaves me a little unclear on what these next 9-10 months of discussions around housing in Seattle are actually going to sound like.
Yeah. No, it's difficult to read the tea leaves on this one. That's a very good observation, David. I did want to talk about something, though, that Councilmember Morales is working on, potentially a new alliance in the council, if you want to look at it that way, specifically with Councilmember Kettle on a measure intended to prevent fires in vacant buildings. Happens more than you might think here. The mayor's office telling us Seattle had 77 vacant building fires in 2021. 91 in 2022, and then 130 last year, which resulted in 3 deaths. This year, there have been 30 so far, including a 3-alarm blaze on First Hill, displaced neighbors in a nearby building, shut down a major arterial for weeks. So they got this new legislation co-sponsored by Kettle and Morales that would allow the Seattle Fire Department to demolish these buildings as necessary and then place a lien on the property to recover costs of that. I wanted to talk about this, David, because it's an interesting situation with these vacant buildings, but potentially a political win, I guess, for Councilmember Morales after that challenging situation with connected communities?
Yeah, political win, possibly. I mean, it's a fairly, it doesn't, I haven't heard any kind of opposition to this yet.
Right, pretty low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, so it doesn't seem like it's going to be a big, big fight. I mean, really what it does is it just puts more power in the hands of the fire department. And because there are paths to demolishing buildings in Seattle. It just sometimes it can take a really long time
right.
in the current process that I have to go through Office of Planning and Construction and Development. And so this basically just like shifts that power to the Seattle Fire Department and speeds up their ability to tear down these buildings if they need to. Which again, I mean, we're not even talking about sort of public nuisance or maybe some buildings that are a little more controversial or some statues that might be a little more controversial. I mean, we're literally talking about buildings that have caught fire already several times that have posed a sort of structural danger to firefighters who have gone inside, and certainly a kind of blight on the neighborhoods that they're in. So I haven't heard anyone who does not, who's not basically okay with speeding up this process. And, but, you know, I mean, it does give Morales maybe a little momentum and shows, you know, again, it's a signal that though she is the progressive on the council, quote unquote, she's willing to work with Mayor Harrell on this stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, she ran against Mayor Harrell and almost beat him in 2015.
Yeah. In District 2, right. Yeah.
They have every reason to not like each other, but here they are working together on a piece of legislation. So I think it's a signal from her and on Harrell's part that she's willing to work with anybody. That hasn't paid dividends yet, as we've seen with her previous piece of legislation.
Right, right. I'm interested to see what happens with this one, too, because I just had no idea that there were that many fires going on in these vacant buildings. But hopefully it is something that the council can work on and the fire department can work on. And as it turns out, most of the fires were actually in District 2 in these vacant buildings here. So definitely something the council member Morales is concerned about. We'll see where this legislation goes. Again, it looks like it's got good support from around the council and certainly from the mayor's office. All right. What do we got coming up next? I'll tell you. What impact will a new transportation plan from the council have on the way we get around the city? And what will we pay for a transportation levy this fall? We're going to learn a little bit more coming up on Now Hear This. Okay, so this week the council has approved a transportation plan. It's a resolution, so more of an aspirational document meant to guide some of the big picture priorities the city has when it comes to transportation. Transportation Committee Chair Rob Sokka pointed out this 142-page document is the product of a lot of work from several departments, including the council, which spent three committee meetings revising this proposal.
Obviously, this is on top of a 2 years of intensive public outreach by SDOT and the mayor's office, and then this council came in and, from my perspective, put its own unique stamp and it made it even better.
Well, David, Councilmember Sokka says this council has made this transportation plan even better than it was before. But I guess my big question is, what does this plan really do? I know we discussed this briefly on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. I just wanted your take on what this more finalized document is all about.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, this is probably more for people who work at the city than anyone else, because it doesn't literally do anything. There's no
dollar involved. Amounts attached to this stuff, right?
Yeah, there's no money involved. There's no deadlines they have to meet. But, you know, and that's not to say that it doesn't have any value. It's just not actually a binding piece of legislation. That comes in the form of the levies that we've talked about and, you know, city legislation. But what it does do is, you know, you do need some kind of organizing principle as a large city and to think about transportation and how you want to improve the transportation system. Because, you know, if you're just scrambling from one thing to the next, you're going to get inequity in who's getting transportation dollars and who's not. Mm-hmm. Bias toward one kind of transportation mode versus the other.
Right.
Things that don't link up to each other. So, of course, you need some kind of guiding document to make sure that there is some continuity and fluidity in the transportation system. And that's what this is trying to do. So, again, not lacking value, but lacking perhaps, you know, meat at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Did it say to you anything about where or how the council wants to shape the transportation levy or make any changes there to that $1.35 billion package that the mayor gave them?
No, I mean, you know, the levy, it's interesting. We saw the levy has been introduced before this was finally passed.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think the plan lays out some projects that are of varying degrees of priority, and the levy, you know, proposes funding some of those. So, you know, talking improvements to Market Street or Aurora or, 23rd north of Madison, you know, I'm adding more bus lanes. So, you know, it sort of dovetails with the levy because, and, you know, theoretically could make a future levy easier as well, because it's like, it's, you know, when they're going to write the levy and lay out what voters are going to choose, they're not starting from scratch now. They've got
right.
a document they can go and look at and say, here's yeah. what we've identified as our priorities. Now we just need to decide, we need to triage them a little bit. What do we want to fund in this next package? And so that's how these two things, I think, dovetail together.
You wrote briefly about one of the amendments that Councilmember Kettle put in this plan, which was to roll back the proposed designation of Pike Place, the street, of course, running through the downtown market there, as an event street, which could be closed to cars occasionally. Was there anything more to this? I know that there's been a lot of pressure to try to reduce the amount of cars that are in that area, certainly dangerous for pedestrians, but I know a lot of the merchants there need those cars to be dropping off things, et cetera. Can you talk about that piece, what Kettle's referring to here?
Yeah, so the plan identifies, defined Pike Place, which is the street that goes through Pike Place Market, as an event street. As you said, it basically means it's, for the most part, open to cars, but sometimes it will be shut down for events. Mm-hmm. In reality, that is what that street already is. Pike Place closes down that street fairly regularly, especially around the holidays right. or in the summer or on, you know, super
right,
busy
right.
weekend. So, you know, as far as what SDOT's definition of event street and how it's being used now, I don't see a lot of daylight between the two of them. I think the real debate that was happening, without maybe always being super explicit about it, is who has control over what that street actually
yeah.
is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what Kettle was trying to do is the fact of that event street designation, even though it is basically what the street is now,
mm-hmm.
being kind of placed on Pike Place. I think there was some squeamishness among the people at the Pike Place PDA and the Historical Commission that the city was kind of inserting itself into the governance of that street when they really want to retain control of that.
Yeah.
That's what I think Kettle is doing, is ensuring that it is not really SDOT or Seattle's decision what's happening with that street. It is still the markets and, you know, the people who run the market. You know, I think that that's a frustration for people who want to see some changes to how that space is used, because I do think if in the hands of the city of Seattle, there's probably more appetite for, you know, reducing the number of vehicles moving through there than there is at the market itself.
Got it. Okay.
But, you know, if there was any movement towards removing cars from Pike Place, I think that it sounds like this amendment now sets up a process, I suppose.
Okay.
For discussing how that street is used in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Processes oftentimes are just ways of kicking a sort
yeah.
of tricky issue down the road further. So
yeah.
we will see if which one of these that process actually is.
Yeah, there's a reason the phrase Seattle process is, those
yeah.
two words are often linked together. So I appreciate what you're saying there. I wanted to touch on a few other things here with you folks, and just keeping everybody up to date, the council is refining its app-based worker legislation this week. We discussed that on the podcast a couple of weeks ago. We'll keep you posted on the final tweaks to that. It'll turn into a reduction of the overall wage, it looks like. Some drivers speaking out about their concerns with this week, other voicing support. We'll see what happens there. But David, I wanted to talk about a new issue I really want to keep track of. It's in the Housing and Human Services Committee this week, extending the multifamily tax exemption. The MFTE, as it's sometimes called, offers tax breaks to builders who are building multifamily units, especially affordable units. So these property owners get this tax break for 12 years. And David, it appears now the city is saying this: if you want to keep those tax exemptions, well, guess what? You have to provide homes that are affordable to households at even lower income levels, meaning if they were at the 80% income level, guess what? Now you're going to have to provide it at the 65% income level, things of that nature. I wanted your take on what the council is considering here and maybe how it can impact housing providers out there.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I don't know how it plays out. I mean, I think a lot of housing providers, when you're talking about changes like this, the balance is always, how do you kind of ensure that the people you want to serve are being served, which is people who are not earning very much money.
Right.
But the tax exemption is just an exemption, and it's not a subsidy. And so it still does have to pencil out for the developers. And if, you know, they're not collecting as much rent from the people who are living in those units,
yeah.
you know, the concern is that, you know, maybe some units are become affordable to people earning less, but
mm-hmm.
perhaps you end up building fewer units altogether because you know, the math just gets a little bit harder if they're geared towards folks earning below a certain amount.
Right.
Therefore pay less rent. So, it's interesting. I mean, I think you could expand that discussion to a lot of things like mandatory housing affordability.
Right.
Are they accomplishing the goals, which are fairly explicit, of providing affordable housing, or are they in a sort of roundabout way undermining those goals by making it harder and more expensive to build and maintain housing?
That's kind of where I was going with this whole thought in my head, too, because I'm trying to figure out, and it's difficult to really glean this, but just how successful the MFTE program has been. And I think that's the focus here. How are these providers reacting to it? And what is the city's role? And what should that city role be? And is there a way that you put a law in place that makes it more difficult for housing to be built? I think if you talk to a lot of providers out there, they're wanting fewer of these different restrictions on them. And it just makes me think about, with this in particular, MFTE and MHA as well, a lot of times there is the ability to, okay, we may not be able to build the units, but we'll pay into this fee in lieu program that the city has set up. So the units don't get built, but the city does get this extra money. And having that extra money is great, but that doesn't always translate into extra units that even the city can build quickly. It turns into an issue of timing for me and how quickly these units can be generated. Do you see where I'm going there?
Yeah, no, exactly. I agree with what you were saying 100%. Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated system in some ways. I mean, tax exemptions and tax breaks and requirements tend to be a little more roundabout than just, housing levy is kind of the most straightforward way we fund housing. It's just property owners pay property taxes and city uses that money to, build housing.
To build
MHA
stuff,
yeah. And MFTE are a little more roundabout in their implementation. And therefore, I think a little... To some degree, a little more difficult to track their overall effectiveness.
Yeah. This is something that I know we're going to be watching over the next couple of weeks here. So we'll see what the MFTE is all about, see if it gets extended by the council. It's definitely something they're pushing for right now, and we'll see some action on this before the end of the year. All right, well, coming up, we're jumping back to transportation and trying to answer one of our patrons' questions when it comes to where the city is spending its dollars. A lot going on here. Thank you very much for the question, Eric. It's coming up next on You Ask, We Answer. Well, here we go with You Ask, We Answer. And a big shout out to Eric for sending in this question. And everybody else, if you are a patron of the show, please do send in some questions. We've been trying to answer them over the past couple of weeks. Blake had a great one not too long ago. There have been some others as well. We really want to make sure that we're hearing from you. Become a patron and send us an email at SeattleNewsViewsAndBrews@gmail.com. Spell it all out there. We'll make sure we answer your question on the show, do some research on it, and get back to you as well. Here's the question from Eric. David, let's try to break this down if we can. Eric asks this. Can you say how many dollars we spend on cyclists and pedestrians in Seattle for every $100 we spend on transit? My sense is that it is shockingly little, perhaps less than $1. In terms of numbers I'm aware of, the entire Seattle Bicycle Master Plan has a cost estimate of less than $500 million, while Sound Transit 3 has a cost of $54 billion, which doesn't include King County Metro and such. So, Eric, I appreciate the question. These numbers are a little difficult to reckon with each other. I do know that the Levy to Move Seattle, the one that's in place right now, provides $65 million over a nine-year period with this goal to build protected bike lanes, buffered bike lanes and neighborhood greenways, which are good for cyclists and for walkers there. It also provides $7 million for programs, including maintenance and bicycle parking. And also, the levy provides $8 million a year for implementation of the Bicycle Master Plan. So that's something to consider on that side of things. And then looking at Sound Transit budget, if you really want to look at that, yeah, you're right. It's off the charts. $3.1 billion spent in 2024. So I just wanted your take on this, David. It's kind of an apples and oranges type of thing when you try to talk about what we're spending on bikes versus what we're spending on transit. But it's a big difference there. And I wonder how that strikes you when you try to compare those two things.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't want nor need to spend $54 billion on bike lanes because...
Well, Eric would, but yeah, keep going.
Because they're cheap. I mean, compared to a new light rail line, a new bike lane is, I don't know what the per foot
cost is,
right? Cost to build a bike lane, but significantly cheaper, I would say, than building a light rail line. Mm-hmm. So, I think some people kind of see these things as being connected, which is you want bike lanes that kind of bridge transit to an extent. I mean, I think a lot of folks who want to see more bike lanes might draw the comparison instead to roads. I mean, what's being spent on cars?
Yep.
Which again, roads are more expensive than bike lanes as well. But like,
yeah.
I think the argument is, I think someone who uses bike facilities is more likely to kind of use them and link together transit, mm-hmm. participate in that network. Should it be fully built out? Whereas the hope, I think, for some with building bike lanes and a better bike lane network is you're actually getting people out of their cars.
Yep.
And so in that sense, I think a lot of folks probably see the spending on cars and spending on bikes as being in a little more direct competition than spending on bikes versus spending on transit, because transit and bike users, I think, are more likely to overlap than maybe bike users and cars.
Right. Do you see that discussion, I guess? I know it was happening during the McGinn era a while ago. I'm talking about 2011, 2012, where it was war on cars, etc. I feel like that kind of rhetoric has ebbed away a little bit, but that whole concept of the competition between modes is still there. How have you seen that discussion change over the last couple of years, David?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, no one's talking about a war on cars, although, you know, when Mayor Harrell was running, he was pretty explicit that, like, cars were a mode of transportation that he still supported and wanted to build out. I don't remember exactly what the quote is, but
I remember what you're saying, though. Yeah.
In some debate, he talked about, you know, not wanting to basically focus on bikes at the expense of people in cars. So,
yes,
I think there is still a level of competition there for sure. You know, and I'm not a transportation reporter anymore, but I was, and I can tell you, we'd get messages from people on both sides if, you know, you wrote too much about what we're doing for cars, and you're from folks about bikes and vice versa. Yeah.
Right.
So I think there is probably still competition. On the other hand, you know, and I think there has been a lot of legitimate progress on adding bike lanes to the city. Mm-hmm. The world hasn't collapsed, although the pandemic had something to do with that. The congestion was already down. And, you know, people still do complain about the existence of bike lanes, but I think they are becoming a little more present and part of people's daily lives. Yeah. And honestly, you know, if you look at the polling the city has done or other people have done, I do think that the kind of opposition to bike lanes is probably a little overstated. I think most people in Seattle support building out bike lanes or alternatives to cars. Mm-hmm. I think also most people in Seattle are not exclusive bike users and do drive occasionally. And so I think that there's probably a little more parity there than some of the loudest voices suggest there are.
Sure. Yeah, we're treading on that very dangerous middle ground, David. It's always interesting to see how that plays out. And Eric, I appreciate the question, and I hope we got at least a little bit of a discussion going on it in your head. And thank you very much for sending that in. Again, if you've got a question, you're a patron, send it to SeattleNewsViewsAndBrews@gmail.com. David, time to wrap up here, and I got to say, if the baseball season ended today, the Mariners in first place in the American League West. What does that say to you?
It validates that I was fairly sure they weren't as bad of a team as they appeared to be at the start.
It also says that it's April, but yeah, keep going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's better to be a Mariners fan than a Houston Astros fan. And that is something that we have not been able to say very much. So that feels good.
Always feels good. David, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you, everyone who is listening in to this episode of Seattle News, Views, and Brews, where you can always find out what's brewing in local politics. Thanks especially to our patrons who support the show. Thank you, Eric, for sending in that question. Thank you for your support. If you'd like to be a patron, find this podcast on Patreon, Seattle News, Views, and Brews. You can hear us on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you listen, we are there. If you do listen, please do consider becoming a patron too. Thanks for watching on Converge Media as well. See you next time. Seattle News, Views, and Brews is an independent production of Callinan Media Services. Copyright 2024.